tickets. They're not free shuttle buses as the previous ones. Okay. Now, we have time for discussion debate, so please again be as clear as and concise as possible and address your questions to specific speakers. Introduce yourselves, or you may also share with us all your positive or negative experience. This will enrich us all. And then, let's remember that we should strive to have an osmosis between childcare and adult care, so as to get the best of the two worlds, to give the best and the most to both types of patients for whom and with whom we work every day. We attach great importance to this because we realize that otherwise much of what we do in terms of patient care would be useless, would be purposeless. So we need to integrate what we do in terms of child care and adult care. So, any questions?
Titti, c'è qualche intervento in sala? No? Nel frattempo che vi organizzate...
So while we wait for questions and comments, I'd like to address a question to Jos, myself. Now, I work in adult care. And so my experience as regards pediatrics and neonatology in particular is extremely limited. It's absolutely insufficient. But as regards the second picture of the child, the second video, which was suffering, but the total score was 16, if I'm not mistaken. However, I had the impression that it was dyspneic, that he was not breathing well. He was also under restraint, so he could move just the left leg, if I'm not mistaken. He could not move freely. So I wonder whether he was reassessed and further signs were captured. Because, well, he didn't seem to be in a state of psychomotor agitation. He didn't seem to be crying. But, well, there was something different in respect of the first child we saw.
Hold on. I use this. I do agree with you because last week during this course in Austria, we were having a discussion with the initiator of the NIDCAP, which is the neonatal individualized development care, and we discussed this movie as well, where we said the position of the child was not as we should have taken care of. There was more comfort you could give, and more comfort under the legs, above the head. Indeed, that that would be the interventions to be done, as the score 16 was relatively low. You could discuss. But here it comes, it's, you observe for 2 minutes and then you have a general scoring what you do. I'm convinced it's a reliable score, since all the nurses are having a training program in every unit, and they do the inter-rater reliability tests between all the nurses. So every nurse who is allowed to do the comfort scoring has to have at least a training, including this inter-rater reliability test. This child definitely, I would think that it was reassessed within a few minutes.
Prego. Si presenti cortesemente. E se ci sono altri interventi, prenotatevi, grazie. Alzate.
Sir, you can raise your hands, and in the meantime we'll give the floor to the speaker. Faniani from Varese Hospital near Milan. We have been working in the framework of the painless hospital, the pain-free hospital, for about 2 years. And in our emergency service, we already submit all our patients to a test, a sort of multiple question test. And then we have also added to the nursing records of the patient the results of these questions on pain, which we ask to all patients who enter any service, actually. We started doing this in post-op surgery, but now we have this questionnaire also in internal medicine nursing records for patients. So this is what we do. And then, what about incident pain? What about incident pain in children and in adults? How do you control incident pain in adults in particular?
Senta, cortesemente, può ripetere?
Sorry, we're not really sure that we got your question. When I talk about incident pain, I mean the patient's pain suffered when there are specific maneuvers. I'm talking about incidental pain or incident pain. That is to say, the pain suffered when the patient undergoes specific maneuvers or procedures. What do you do? For instance, I don't know, physical therapy. You inject morphine before physical therapy and so on and so forth.
Can I have a small comment on that? First of all, I think it is quite difficult to define incident pain because when you do a nasogastrical tube insertion, is that patient, adult patient, is that experiencing pain, and is this just very short incident pain? Or if you go to the burn unit where you do the dressing change, is that an incident pain, because that is a severe incident pain? Yes. So it depends on, again, to this, we talked about this yesterday and today as well, individualized patient-centered care. That means whatever you do at your patients, whether you think it's incidental pain and your patients say, okay, this is too much, I need something, you need to respect your patients and you need to collaborate. First, inform what you're going to do, inform that it could maybe do some harm or pain, and if it's going to do a lot of pain, that your patient can participate and anticipate as well, like, okay, you have to stop or whatever, I like to do something. So the take-home message, in my opinion, talking not only about incidents, pains, is try to focus as much as possible to individualize patient-centered care, whatever you do. Because what I give the example, dressing change and burn patients, you definitely, I hope, but definitely will have a good pain management before you start the dressing. And that's just probably incidental pain for 10 minutes.
Non so come funziona.
Well, this is exactly what we were talking about before. And as regards childcare, I know for sure that there are procedures in which I will induce pain and stress. And, well, I have to inform the patient about that. This is part of WHO recommendations. In an individualized approach for any type of procedure, even if the procedure is just slightly painful, and then I have to opt for the best protocol, the most appropriate protocol for that kind of pain. And I can also use non-pharmacological techniques, which means that I will be able to take a blood sample to position a tube or to catheterize the bladder in full autonomy following these protocols. As regards adults, I think that we should make a point. Now, pain assessment in adults is very often underestimated. Why? Because assessment scales, scoring systems are not really adopted systematically. On the other hand, when the patient is sedated or unconscious, it's very difficult to have tools, instruments, or ways to assess pain in a clear, standardized way. So I think there's still much which should be done in that direction. There's still much which remains to be done in that direction. So all those who work in adult intensive care units should develop these instruments, should apply these instruments to assess the pain in patients, especially incident pain for normal procedures and maneuvers, which are often underestimated, but they tend to be painful. Questions, comments? Good morning. I'm Delia. I work in Bergamo, pediatric intensive care. Now, I have a question for our colleague from Turin. Which one? Maria Cristina, who discussed the case of the Nene. So why did you decide to keep intubation for 15 days with all the risks which intubation involves? Could you speak louder, please? So why did you keep the child intubated for 15 days rather than, I don't know, thinking of an alternative for analgesia, I don't know, epidural catheter or something else? And then, I'd like to ask you whether you also provide psychological counseling for children, parents and relatives, but also for nurses. Well, we decided to keep the child sedated for 15 days because that was, well, that was not a decision we made, you know, like that, rule of thumb. We decided to keep the child sedated for 15 days in the light of the child's clinical course. And over the first 15 days, the child's condition were not really brilliant. I summarized the situation when I spoke this morning, but over the first 15 days, the child was unstable, the child was critical, and those 15 days were days during which the orthopedic surgeon required total immobility of the patient, and well, we had to change dressings, we had to medicate the wounds and so on to treat the wounds, and this was quite long, it was a quite lengthy procedure throughout the day. And so with this 15-day sedation, we were able to treat the child from both the nursing and medical viewpoint with the best available procedures, because he was under sedation. Now, when a nurse interacts with other care providers, well, there is a multiplicity of possible scenarios and interactions. Psychologists can provide important support, but in some cases, social support may also be necessary, because parents very often need to solve problems of daily living. For instance, as Rita said, parents might find themselves far from their home with a child in hospital, or unable to work because they want to be in hospital, and so on. So when I talk about teamwork, I'm not just talking about doctors and nurses, but also about physiotherapists, psychologists, social workers, and so on. I don't know whether you are satisfied by my answer. Any further questions or comments? If it's not the case, I would like to return to the continuity of care in the clinical case illustrated by Cristina Rossi, especially as regards the interaction with other colleagues in the same service, the other colleagues who follow the patient. I'd like to know exactly what tools were used in order to ensure not just continuity of care, but also continuity of pain assessment. Well, indeed. What we opted for was not to say, okay, we've dealt with the child for 15 days, now it's up to the orthopedic service and we don't give a damn any longer. No, we decided that we wanted to guarantee the continuity of care in terms of physical pain control, but also in terms of psychological results. And it was also the continuity of these psychological results which we wanted to ensure. And there is another point which, if I'm not mistaken, was raised yesterday too. That is to say that pain tends to be watched, measured more in intensive care and resuscitation units, because both doctors and nurses in ICUs and resuscitation tend to be more sensitive. For instance, doctors who work in resuscitation units tend to be anesthetists, and so an anesthetist resuscitator is a doctor who is used to work with certain drugs and who is, well, someone who professionally controls pain. However, the problem arises when the patient leaves intensive care. And in that respect, what is important is ensuring that the team, the intensive care team, should establish a good relationship with the service to which the child or the patient will be discharged, so that actually the patient is not just managed first by the intensive care unit and then by second service or ward, but rather the patient should be jointly managed by both services so that they share the same goals. This means that if the ICU team works correctly in this direction, then the second service or ward will also become more sensitive to pain issues, despite the fact that it might be a ward or service where pain is not really a problem which is often felt or dealt with. Any other questions or comments? Or perhaps any experience you'd like to share with us? Yes, there at the top.
Buongiorno, sono Giardi da Roma.
My name is Giardi and I come from Rome. I'd like to make a comment. In 99% of cases, nurses cannot comply with their code of conduct and they cannot respect or meet the agreement made with citizens or the charter of services. That's all. Just a remark. Yeah, it's a shame. I do agree with you that there are many reasons explaining why this happens. We haven't got enough time. Sometimes we're disappointed. Maybe training is not appropriate. I think it's important to understand why. In our daily work, we tend to comply with our mission, and we try to do so with professionalism by respecting our patients. We all believe that it's important to be accountable. I'm saying that nurses cannot work properly because workloads increased over the years and there's a shortage of nurses. So it's impossible to comply with our code of conduct. Well, they should be the basis for our activity. May I say something? I would like to reply. I believe that we share the same situation in our area. I don't know where you are, so thank you. Thank you for showing where you are. We try to tackle this problem. How can we solve the problems we have to face in our daily practice while complying with the values embedded in our code of conduct? Maybe I'm going against what has been said by Jos, but we try to organize ourselves in a way that maybe is not really organized, it's not really structured. We decided to use the facial expression scale. Jos said that it's not a perfect instrument, and he's right in saying so. But we decided to adopt this scale, and we worked on 20, 30, 40 patients, and little by little you understand how to use this instrument, and you, and at a given time you know that some patients require a longer pain assessment. So this is a way to avoid a waste of energy, because in some cases you need 2 minutes and even more to assess pain. In other patients, this is not always necessary. So, and even if this scale helps us in performing a proper assessment in one patient, I think it's worthwhile. But this is our situation. It's not easy. It's not easy to tackle our problems, but we've got to find a solution to comply with our code of conduct. I would like to make a contribution, and then I'd like to ask one more question to Jos. What has been said by our colleague in the audience reflects our daily experience, but it's important to live our work, to experience our work, trying to find possible solutions to our problems. Yesterday and today, we have been discussing some cases, practical cases, of patients in pain, and we try to adopt a model, the so-called complexity of care model. And this model has been adopted in order to understand which activities must absolutely be carried out by nurses, and then which activities that can be delegated to other professional health caregivers. And this is a method, but there are many others available. This is a method which is useful to identify priorities and work on those priorities first, together with other healthcare professionals, because there are other healthcare professionals who get paid to do their job and who can help us so that we've got enough time to do our job properly. Well, this is a very complex situation, and our colleagues' presentations were clear from that point of view, but this is the path I think we've got to follow if we want to work in the best possible way. We cannot do everything. We've got to work on nursing care, because nursing care is our responsibility. We're accountable for that. And we've got to help our patients to avoid pain, or we've got to relieve their pain. And this session has been devoted to children. And we have heard that there are many solutions to avoid pain. Jos showed us two films, and also the other colleagues made a very useful contribution because they told us that nurses can do a lot to eliminate pain-inducing factors. I also think that we've got to focus on another aspect, because as to pain management, we've got many things to learn, and we've got to learn from whatever is available. And yesterday's and today's session have been organized in order to have an exchange of views, so that together we are able to identify best practices or good examples in order to relieve pain in children and adults. And this in order to share experiences, and we know that nurses treating adults have some competencies, nurses treating children have other competencies. And I've got a question for Jos. In your experience, according to your experience, can you give us some indications on how to transfer skills and competencies? Or in your experience, nurses working with adult patients and nurses working with children, have they ever decided to work together in order to achieve better results in terms of care for both children and adults? So do you know any such experiences of trying to work together? Are you aware of any experiences of this kind in your country, so that we can profit from your experience?
I think it's a very challenging question. Going from an upper level, from experiences, I would say yes, I have experiences, because what I observe in Holland is the Dutch association, it's adult, pediatric and neonatal intensive care, and they work together to have our profession, our critical care profession, recognized and on a higher professional standards. So this is in Holland. But if you look, for instance, as you know, the European Federation of Critical Care Nursing Associations, most of the national societies who are member of the European Federation, they are working together with the adult and pediatric and neonatal critical care nurses locally. So this federation is sort of trying to have a balance between working together and achieving more with all critical care nurses. So that's on a high level. If you go down, a level down on hospital level, is that it might vary per hospital that adult intensive care works closely together with the pediatric intensive care. Some hospitals I know, they work very closely that the adults are working also on the pediatric intensive care. That mixture is quite positive. It has a positive impact. Because you have to realize, in history, adult critical care was developed 50 years ago or so. Pediatric intensive care, the first recognizable pediatric intensive care was 25, 30 years ago. So, of course, pediatric intensive care was jumping on the train of developments of adult intensive care, and in particular the adult intensive care nursing. But meanwhile, we need to collaborate, because all the advanced developments, you see the high frequency oscillation ventilation techniques developed from neonatal and pediatric intensive care, it's coming into adults. So we have a reverse effect. Various nursing developments are based or originate from the adult intensive care, but some are coming from the pediatrics. An example is for the adult intensive care, the nurse-led weaning protocols. I know from the literature the nurse-led weaning protocols are firstly developed and tested, and positive outcome has been documented in adult intensive care. However, on nursing professional development, the nurse practitioner, the job nursing practitioner, comes from the neonatal intensive care unit and is now increasingly getting popular in pediatric intensive care and even more popular in adult intensive care. So you see there's always a balance between the developments, clinically, professionally, and from a research point of view, I just say, as every patient population has its own specific needs, research has to be also done in all these various kinds of populations. The latest development, for instance, is that they sort of try to develop, look at the geriatric patients, the very old patients, whether they can develop an ICU for it. Well, besides the ethical question to do so, yes or not, you see highly specialized directions going always, and these directions have a direct influence on the nurses, on the critical care nurses, because you can choose, in the future, you can choose to super specialize yourself in various fields in intensive care.
Sicuramente è arricchente sentire che
it is nice to know that neonatal or pediatric care achievements may make a contribution to adult care. And it would be interesting to have some counseling by some colleagues who have developed specific experiences in their pediatric units, but these competencies and experiences then can be transferred to adult care. We have been participating in working groups with much enthusiasm. We thought it was an opportunity for professional development, and I hope this objective is shared by you all. Working together is always enriching and stimulating. So if there are no other questions, I'd like to give the floor to our president to close this session. I'd like to thank you for your participation, for your contribution, and for the